Hello, and welcome to episode 33 of the Mrs. M's Curiosity Cabinet podcast. Thank you for tuning in to listen to me musing about my making antics. Whether it's your first visit or you are a regular listener, you are very welcome here. For new listeners, I am Meg, and I'm a European English woman based in London. I'm a writer and a craftswoman, designer, maker, and generally curious soul. I am fascinated by natural, elemental, and minimally processed materials, the science embedded in them, and also our long human instinct to manipulate materials, make objects, and tell stories. On a semi-regular basis, I drop by to share some experiences, inspiration, adventures, and observations from my making life. I talk about what I'm working on, but mostly I'm fascinated by the how and why of the making process, from material and environmental considerations of what and how we make to some of the psychological and social reasons and implications of our making. Between episodes, you can find me on Instagram at Mrs. M Curiosity Cabinet, and that is with an underscore between each word. I also occasionally put some footage up on YouTube to accompany these podcasts at Mrs. M's Curiosity Cabinet. It feels a bit odd to talk of regular listeners and semi-regular podcasts, as it's been quite a while since I last switched the microphone on. Nearly a year and a half, in fact. As is so often the case, I hadn't planned to take such a long break from podcasting. Normally podcasters and vloggers explain extended absences by referring to life happening or health issues, both entirely sound reasons, and especially so for anybody living with a chronic health condition. In my case, the time away originally happened for two reasons. On the one hand, a desire to harness the pockets of energy I've had in recent years to revisit old interests and explore new ones. And on the other hand, an ever greater need to work out how to deal with some less than stellar emotions. This resulted in me flexing my creative muscles, skills, boundaries, and comfort zones in ways that were challenging and exciting, but also confronting, frustrating, and generally exhausting. And with all that going on, there was neither the energy nor the mental clarity to share anything in an articulate way. The time away from podcasting left me torn about whether I would return to it. For one, as energy is precious, it was nice to be able to use it for non-screen activities. Secondly, there's also something nice about the anonymity that accompanies being offline. I've never been somebody who has sought a large following, but even with a modest podcast, I'm aware that I am a pretty quiet and private person, actively choosing how much or how little I want to share. However, as much as I value privacy and anonymity, particularly when working through challenges and changes, I have felt a little isolated. This is not an unusual feeling for people living with chronic conditions like fibromyalgia, but I suspect I felt it more acutely in the past 2 years as most of society has gone back to, in inverted commas, normal after the COVID lockdown years and has quite understandably not realised that for many people, their normal still involves a form of lockdown. As surreal as it may sound, podcasting has given me connections and conversations, and I suppose I have missed that. I have also been really touched by listeners who have contacted me, given my prolonged absence, to check whether I'm okay and mentioned that they missed the podcast. Community is a word that tends to get overused in the digital space, but it is really comforting to know that no matter how grim the world can feel at times, we are all embedded in connections and relationships that can be meaningful, even if they don't take the form that they may have done in centuries gone by. All that being said, I have decided to hit record again. Normally I would launch straight into talking about the nuts and bolts of the projects I've been working on, but the prolonged break is a great opportunity to change things up. My making and creative practices have evolved, just as I have, so it's only natural that I will want to share different stories and highlight unfolding experiences and perspectives, particularly as the why and the how have always been more interesting to me than the what. Let's start with some positive developments. It's 7.5 years since I was diagnosed with fibromyalgia, and my condition has definitely improved in those years. There was the slow and incremental improvement from the low point of a 2 hour per day energy envelope in 2016 to about 5 hours of energy per day and covering small distances with a walking stick by 2019. Since the pandemic, though, no matter how grim that was on many levels, my pain and fatigue levels actually improved considerably. I still need to pace myself carefully and work within limitations or pay for overshooting my energy envelope, but I have generally been physically stronger than I have been in a long time. And with that came a desire to reclaim parts of the old me, or just see what I'm now capable of. In the past 18 months or so, I've been testing out what old interests might be possible again, with adaptations or compromises, and also what rekindling of old skills might look like, both in terms of practicalities and how they might bed into the life and creative practice that have emerged in the intervening years and decades. So in the past 2 years or so, I've been reacquainting myself with my interest in analogue photography, and I've also started hitting a range of materials. My interest in film and the darkroom is on the surface one of the less physically demanding activities, leaving aside the lunging, squatting and balancing needed to take photos, of course. It does, however, involve a degree of mental alertness and manual dexterity, given the concoctions and processes involved. Also, in an effort to enjoy the darkroom in a less environmentally harmful way, it requires me to tap into my natural curiosity, deploy my analytical brain, and delve into my scant knowledge of chemistry. Photography also means I'm spending more time outside, not on epic adventures or long photo walks, but getting out and about locally where I can spend time amongst unassuming urban wildlife, soak up a little vitamin D, and generally ease the depressive tendencies which are particularly acute in the winter months. Rekindling my love of wood has also been getting me outside, but has obviously been a more physical process, and actually that was entirely what I needed. The past 2 years in particular have felt pretty tumultuous. There has been a whole raft of issues affecting society as a whole, from inertia about pressing ecological issues to food and energy concerns, not to mention war and famine further afield. There has also been a long list of political developments and bumbling that have left me, quite frankly, seething. Before anyone turns off, particularly newcomers who don't yet have the measure of me, I make a point of keeping party politics out of my podcast. As someone trained in negotiating, my instinct is for constructive, nuanced, mutual exploration and problem solving, rather than screaming it at each other across the ether. Like anyone who is concerned about the environment, our shared ecosystem, wildlife, or even at its most basic level, what kind of water and harvest our children, grandchildren, nieces, nephews might enjoy in decades to come, at some point I come up against the role of policies, regulations, organisations and infrastructure, and that necessarily means coming up against politics, or at the very least hoping for grown-up actors in that arena. Given the roller coaster of political developments we've experienced in the UK, particularly in the past 2 years, it's fair to say it's been an exhausting, infuriating, and downright surreal white knuckle ride. And I suppose I just snapped. Or rather, I knew I needed to spend some time working out how best to handle my frustrations and anger constructively to avoid becoming just another angry, shouty voice on the interwebs. Because let's be honest, there's more than enough of those. So in the past 2 years, I used some of my newfound strength and larger energy envelope to dip my toe back into hitting wood and metal, thanks to a couple of workshops. I'm aware that makes me sound like a child having a tantrum, and in some ways it probably started like that. But mostly it was a way to dissipate some of the pent-up feelings by harnessing them into directed energy. Not just to produce an object, but also to clear my head for the more significant things in life. As happenstance would have it, a couple of those workshops coincided with pivotal political dates, so that gave the rediscovery of old skills and materials added poignancy. More importantly, though, I discovered a number of things. First, I realised to my delight that with sensible pacing, I can still shape wood with axe, knife, and gouges. What is more, I discovered I have a particular affinity for pole lathe turning, possibly due to my experience with the spinning wheel and pottery wheel. Secondly, due to the gentle, nurturing atmosphere of the tutors and members and the pleasant location, I thoroughly enjoyed spending time at London Greenwood in particular. So after a couple of spoon carving workshops, I decided to try the induction course so I could join this co-op. London Greenwood has an outdoor space nestled in a corner of Hackney City Farm. It has become a place I can take myself off to if I want to work on a specific project with wood rescued from local tree surgeons or councils, or just enjoy some quiet headspace or congenial company while carving away on a small project. Importantly, it is also a place where I can be outside in relative comfort, even in the darker months when the stifling cloak of seasonal depression looms large. Although less than constructive feelings drove me to hit wood, it has actually proved beneficial in all manner of ways. It has stretched my physical boundaries, helped my sense of community, and expanded my own creative practice. Being a beginner or a returner with rusty skills, questionable dexterity, and an abundant lack of experience is frustrating, but it's also exciting. One of the common features of a chronic illness is you are very aware of what you can't or can no longer do. Tackling something new can feel more daunting than it might previously have done. And due to limited energy, strength, resources, there is definitely a tendency to dismiss possibilities and opportunities based on practicalities. Will I have the strength for it? Will I have the energy to complete a session, let alone get home? Can I afford it? And if so, can I justify the cost if I need to leave a little earlier? And so on and so on. Yes, I've definitely needed compromises and adjustments, but it has been really uplifting to discover possibilities, use and move my body in different ways, and meet people with similar interests. Returning to old interests with new eyes and exploring new ones has stretched my instinct and creative practice in unexpected directions, which I will obviously share more about in the future. Not just in terms of materials, skills building, frustrations, dilemmas, and tangible outputs, but also the unexpected practical projects that support or result from intertwining strands of my creative practice. Let's start with one such practical project. I know many people love pockets, but I'm a bag girl. If I were a phone, bank card and keys only person, maybe pockets would be plenty, but heading outdoors also involves carrying allergy medication and adrenaline, pen and notebook, and the in-between spectacles. The ones that opticians know as AV or computer screen spectacles, but they cover many more uses, from reading book spines in library and shelf labels in shops to axing and gouging in woodwork. In fact, pretty much anything between the general spectacles to be able to see to cross the road and the reading spectacles needed for close-up work or reading ingredients labels. Once carrying this extra pair of spectacles around became unavoidable, I increasingly thought I need a larger handbag, but adding a camera to my regular gear focused my mind. Yes, I could just put the extra stuff in a small rucksack, but a crossbody bag makes more sense for two reasons. For one, it means the spectacles and camera are within ready reach. More importantly though, given my very foggy brain, it feels more secure to carry a camera on the front of my body. The areas I venture out to are not particularly dangerous, but London is a big city with all the related petty crime, so I have to have my wits about me, particularly if I'm carrying anything valuable. I don't use any fancy cameras or anything particularly expensive, but given that most film cameras are second hand, and in my case quite old, they are precious to me. So last month, I decided to make a bag that I had admired since I first saw the pattern, the Merchant & Mills Factotum bag. This is a crossbody bag sized somewhere between a small handbag and a satchel. It has a main pocket shaped by a front and back panel and a generous gusset closed with a zip, and also two small front pockets which are covered by an ingenious front flap and are perfectly sized for a phone, travel card and handkerchief. The pattern is designed for oilskin cotton or heavy canvas, is lined and can be made with either a leather or webbing strap. The pattern is beautifully designed, but due to the ample stitched-on front pockets and the gusset, it definitely requires precision. As I was using oil skin, which doesn't take chalk marks and cannot be washed, I set about transferring all marks with tailor's tacks, all 70 of them. And then I started work on the front panel and attached the pockets. Watching the excellent design and engineering of this pattern turn 2D panels into a 3D bag was a joy, but the actual stitching of the bag was a right royal pain. Literally. Not because there is anything wrong with the design or the pattern, rather because my sewing machine lacked the grunt needed to get through the multiple layers of oilskin. I knew that it would be a heavy-duty project before I started, so I invested in the right kind of jeans needles and changed them regularly. For the final step of the pockets, which involved stitching through 7 layers, my poor machine threw a complete fit, and I resorted to sewing 4 crosses in each top corner of the pocket by hands and pliers. In the process, I stabbed myself 3 times, despite wearing a thimble, and bent 4 needles, i.e. 1 per cross. What with the hand stitching, squinting to ensure maximum accuracy despite wearing reading spectacles, and attaching a gusset to multiple layers across a zip, this project definitely took a toll on my body, even though I broke it down into what I thought were manageable chunks. Apart from the little bit of hand sewing out of necessity and lengthening the strap, I followed the pattern to the letter. If I make this pattern again, which I probably will with a machine with a bit more power, there are a few things I would change. I'd probably sew a small inside pocket to the back lining, and I would also stitch a piece of buckram to the base of the gusset lining to give the bag a little more structure. Overall, though, I am very happy with my new bag. It is small and light enough for my body, but large enough to take my spectacles, my camera, and even a paper bag. Or on the days I go to the Greenwood Co-op, my carving knife, an item I definitely prefer to carry on the front of my body rather than in a backpack, given the UK's very strict knife laws. In recent months, I've been busy with a couple larger home and garden projects. One such project was a garden bench come greenhouse base come worm hotel. Long-term listeners will know that I have an odd little garden. I affectionately call it the grounds, as it technically is on 3 levels. In reality, though, it's a darkish patio garden crammed full of raised beds and pots that suffers from a bit of an identity crisis, dithering between being an allotment and an urban cottage garden. Over the past 13 years, though, I've managed to grow a fair amount of food in this space, welcomed in wildlife, and generally try to make this eccentric space jolly. Despite all its limitations, I love my little garden, as it's my happy place. No matter how bad the pain, fatigue, frustration, or melancholy are, within minutes of getting my hands into the soil, watching the birds, or talking to the bees and worms, life feels more manageable. In my quest to grow as much food in the garden for us and forage for insects, each year I try to nudge the potential of the garden further. For example, in the past few years I've added a wormery bin to help boost soil health and also got a mini greenhouse. Mini greenhouse is probably over-egging it a bit. What I actually got is 2 apexed shelf units made out of metal pipes and plastic crossbars and clear covers with zippable front that I can pull over the shelf units in colder months. The kind of structure you commonly see in apartment front gardens or side passages of small houses up and down British towns and cities. I'd long questioned the usefulness of these mini greenhouses, doubting their rigidity and durability, but when my sister raved about them during lockdown, I thought I would give them a try. Anything to stretch the season, let me move tomatoes and aubergines out of our living rooms a few weeks earlier, and raise plants off the ground in my dark garden to give them as much sun as possible. In the first year, I placed the greenhouses against the back wall, also known as Tomato Lane, the sunniest spot in the garden. In terms of providing the tomato plantlets with extra warmth during the cooler nights, these mini greenhouses do a very decent job. In terms of supporting larger plants later in the summer, they are decidedly precarious, particularly if they are not on an even surface. Therefore, last year I moved them against the side fence, as that would put them on firmer ground, and placed the wormery under the lowest shelf to provide more shelter against the rain. This helped a bit, but ultimately the design is just not sturdy enough for a four-tier shelf unit. Two levels, no problem. A third with light trays at a push, but four tiers with anything larger than a seedling pot, not really. So after last summer, I decided to rethink the arrangement. I came up with a design that would give me a rigid lower level to house the wormery and form a solid base for a half unit greenhouse. A thriftiness and a desire not to waste the mini plastic clad greenhouses entirely meant I designed the bottom half in wood and would scavenge as many materials from the greenhouses for the upper unit. I reckoned that by shortening the pipe structure and sinking the vertical pipes into wood, it would be more robust. I drew up plans in early autumn and waited for plants to go over before moving things around and making the structure. By late autumn, though, I went down with flu, and before I knew it, we were into the dark, damp December days, so inevitably, I didn't actually get round to the job till February. With the new growing season rapidly approaching, I knew I had to get a move on. After double-checking my measurements and calculations, and the online inventory of our nearest DIY store, Mr. M and I walked down to the shop, picked up the timber for the bench structure, as well as angle supports, and I set to work. My plan was simple. I would build three frames for the legs. I would attach decking boards to the top for the bench. I would reinforce the structure with cross struts between the legs at the front and the back. And to save on wood, I would then repurpose the metal wire shelves from the greenhouse for the shelves under the bench. In a burst of efficiency, I got the jigsaw out and sawed the timber for the framed legs. Then I set about drilling and screwing the steel angle supports into place. Very quickly, I realised that there was a design flaw. Despite being heavy-duty steel, these supports offered no rigidity whatsoever. Back to the drawing board then. How else could I create a strong corner joint with the wood I'd already cut? As I couldn't find any triangular brackets that were large enough, I settled on using steel L-plates for the corners and decided to use T-plates for adding the cross struts. So I returned the unopened packets of angle brackets, but the local DIY store didn't have any L or T plates. After Mr. M gallantly made a detour to pick some up from another shop, I got to work again. I fired up the drill and the ratchet screwdriver, and my heart sank. These plates were better than the angle brackets, but still didn't result in a strong joint. There was a scream, and a swear, and a cup of tea. I realised that there was a fundamental flaw in my design. First, I should probably have sawn the wood for one leg only and made a prototype. More importantly, I should have sawn the wood at a 45 degree angle to make a mitre joint. That would have produced a stronger joint than the butt joint due to more surface area, and the L plates would also have had more purchase. Resawing the legs was no option though, because the measurements were determined by the size of the mini greenhouse top. So I needed to rejig the design again. Instead of frame legs, I decided to base the legs on those of the butcher's block in my studio. Two verticals, joined at the top with a crossbar, and then with two cross struts down the leg for extra rigidity. I would of course need more wood for the extra struts, but fortunately I had enough spare for that. Also, as I now had struts in the legs rather than between the legs, instead of reusing the metal wire shelves, I could make wooden shelves for under the bench and attach them to the cross struts to create extra stability. Once I had built the redesigned legs, I checked what offcuts we had in the garden from previous jobs to make the two shelves. As I didn't want to buy more wood than was necessary, I changed the proportions by moving the middle leg off centre for a narrow shelf above the wormery and a wider shelf for pots and trays on the other side. This meant I could at least use the lone spare decking board from the previous project. So after these tweaks and calculations, I checked online stock levels and off we went again to Wix. I had always planned two trips in search of wood because we don't drive and can only carry so much timber between us. But in this case, this inconvenience actually worked to our advantage. When poor design forced a rethink, I could recalculate the wood we would need for the second phase of the build. I wasn't limited by wood already purchased. While this is pragmatic and true, I admit this perspective definitely involves a spot of hindsight positivity too. In the interest of keeping it real, by the time we went back to Wix for the nth time on this particular project, I was heartily sick of the place. At the time of recording, I have fitted the frame for the upper part of the greenhouse to wooden beams that sit on top of the bench. I still need to cut down the greenhouse plastic, tape the new hem, and create a new stop for the zip with a dab of nail polish, but the whole structure feels a lot more robust. It has also allowed me to tidy up the mishmash of pots, trays, bags of grit and whatnot, which has been particularly gratifying. Needless to say, I was absolutely shattered and moderately frustrated by the time I'd finished the carpentry. As we packed up after dusk, I was also aware that one leg wasn't quite square, so I was annoyed about that too. But there was also a sense of satisfaction that I'd come up with something from scratch myself. The result is far from perfect, and this project certainly tested my grit in terms of strength, design and carpentry skills, patience and indulgence, and also knowing when good enough is enough. Mr. M and I were talking about the project afterwards, in particular how I get myself into a tizzy when things don't go to plan, usually due to lack of skill and experience, my gritty determination to do this stuff myself, and what resilience looks like in that context. I often feel I'm less resilient than I used to be. I used to just take the challenges and setbacks in my stride. But I have to remind myself that a lot of the time that is just the effect of fatigue. Not just the exhaustion that goes with a physical job causing aches and pains and taking longer due to the extra steps, but also that although my determination has not diminished, tenacity takes energy, so I will naturally feel like I've been through the ringer. Why mention these musings? Well, some months ago a very dear friend was asking about my podcast, mentioned she enjoyed them, but also that I always sound so capable and that this can be a bit intimidating. I was a bit taken aback by this and also quite concerned. For one, I don't feel particularly skilled. Mostly though, I don't podcast about my making life to portray some kind of perfect lifestyle, but rather to illustrate how much we are actually capable of, particularly after decades of convenience culture, corporate lobbying and education policy telling us otherwise and eroding our skills and agency. I'm firmly of the mind that none of us spring from the womb knowing how to make clothes, grow food, produce podcasts, build things with our hands, or anything else. However, we as humans have the capacity to inquire, observe, figure things out, develop skills, apply them in practical ways, and so on. After all, it's exactly that capacity that allowed us as a species to stay safe and fed, to move from a hunter-gatherer existence to agriculture, to grind down animal bones to make needles, to smelt iron for tools, to build amazing structures, develop writing, arts and science and the implements needed to pursue those activities, etc. Curiosity is so often the starting point of my making attempts. If I need to deal with practical issues around the home, or I would like XYZ, my first instinct is, how would I go about making it? What would it involve? How did previous generations tackle this? How difficult would it be to make it? And I come up with a plan. That might involve taking my own measurements, knitting a tension swatch and number crunching, or sewing a toile. Or it might involve measuring dimensions, roughing out a design with my appalling drawing skills, and figuring out how to put something together with basic tools and materials. And of course, a lot of unpicking and reworking, or trying things differently next time based on what I'd picked up along the way. Although the medium and tools may vary, the key ingredients in all my making are curiosity, practice, and a hefty dose of dogged determination. Most of the time, I'm just muddling through, and that conversation with my friend reminded me that maybe in the podcast, I should be talking about that fumbling through more often. Not just to avoid discouraging others from trying things, but to actively encourage listeners to roll up their sleeves and have a go at muddling through themselves, and in the process to discover their own agency. Before signing off, on a more light-hearted note, for those who do not yet know, there was an excellent development last year. Two rescue cats moved in with us. Back in December 2022, a good 2 years after our beloved curmudgeonly Dante died, I started looking out for potential feline adoptees. Shortly before Christmas 2022, I spotted a pair of moggies on the website of London Inner City Kitties, who instantly tugged at our heartstrings. The adoption process seemed to take ages due to the checks and procedures, but in early February, two senior moggies around 10 years old moved in with us. Heather is a petite tortoiseshell with beautiful markings and a very cuddly disposition. She's the braver of the two, but not without her nervous moments. She's definitely not a fan of suits and hates the cutting mat, but doesn't bat an eyelid at the Hoover. Toby, by contrast, is a terrified cat, but incredibly handsome in his dressed-for-dinner black and white jacket. Heather found her paws almost immediately, working out that I am good for tarty head rolls and tickles behind the ears, and that Mr. M's left leg is perfectly sized for her tiny body. Bit by bit, Toby has started to relax, finding security in the quiet routine of his new home, safe in the knowledge that Heather, his comfort blanket, is never far away. We don't think he will ever be a lap cat or love human interaction, but these days he does groom himself in front of us and doesn't flinch when we put out extra toys at night. More recently, he has also demonstrated a kittenish head roll, paws in the air move that Heather has obviously been teaching him, much to the delight of his humans, of course. Well, after a bit of a rambling return podcast, I'll sign off for now. I'll be back soon, but till next time, I hope you enjoy many happy hours of making, whatever your medium may be.